Good morning, I'm Kathleen Stevenson. I'm here with writer and activist Rebecca Solnit. Rebecca Solnit is the award-winning author of numerous books. Her latest is the one that's out in paperback, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. Rebecca Solnit will be speaking in Portland tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church Sanctuary at 1211 Southwest Main Street. She will deliver the first Sewell Lecture, Speaking of Justice, which will be a yearly event bringing to the community an emerging voice for social justice. Rebecca Solnit, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I want to mention that, stay tuned, we will have a pair or more of tickets to give away to Rebecca's talk tonight, so stay tuned. You have visited New Orleans 11 times since Katrina. Can you talk about why you've been there so many times?
The first time, I just wanted to see what the storm had done and how the city was doing. I'd been writing about disaster before the storm hit. In fact, I was on, I had a piece about how people behave in disaster go to press in Harper's Magazine the day Katrina hit. And I thought, oh my God, we're not done with this story now. And, you know, and I just got more and more involved. I got involved in solving some of the crimes that had taken place during the crisis. I got involved with some people and some very strong friendships. And it was just fascinating. It has been fascinating being a witness. And when I went there 6 months after Katrina, it looked like the storm had hit, you know, a week ago. And the city was empty. It was wrecked. There were flipped cars and broken trees and debris all over the place. And it was, I didn't know if the city was going to come back to life. So it's been fascinating going a few times a year ever since and seeing it come back to life very vibrantly in many ways and in ways nobody expected.
Mm. Yeah, I'd like to talk about some of the ways that nobody expected. Do you want to talk about a few of those now?
Well, one of the really extraordinary things, there were some terrible crimes that committed during Katrina by the police, by these white vigilantes I wrote about and other groups. But there were remarkable things that numerically greatly outnumber them. The number of people who were rescued by volunteers in boats, the number of, you know, the soup kitchens, of volunteer efforts of people who came. Some estimates are that more than 1 million volunteers have come to New Orleans to help the city rebuild, help people come home, help put it back together and care for these people who went through something so grueling. And that's astonishing. And it's like a Freedom Summer, except Freedom Summer was the tens of thousands. This is, you know, hundreds of thousands. And some of the projects like Common Ground Clinic, NINA, the Lower Ninth Ward Neighborhood Empowerment Network Association, are still going strong. So, and a lot of people who came as volunteers have moved into the city. So there's this very galvanized, involved, and committed sense of community and sense of popular power. And a sense, like after the Mexico City earthquake in 1985, civil society awoke in a way in New Orleans. It was a city that had enormous public life and the festive carnival party in the street sense. But it now has one also in the engagement in process, the discussion of why New Orleans matters, what a city means, what the future could look like and should look like, what disaster response should be. So it's a very conscious place and a very passionate place right now.
Mm-hmm. And maybe tell a little bit more about Mexico City and how that relates, because part of your book is relating other disaster areas.
Yeah, my book is really about five major disasters, from the 1906 earthquake in my own city, San Francisco, to Hurricane Katrina, including 9/11, the Halifax explosion in Nova Scotia in 1917, and the Mexico City earthquake of 1985. A disaster unfolds a little like a revolution. Nobody's in charge. Anything seems possible, and all men are brothers, is the general atmosphere. And then often that subsides, and it can unfold in many different ways from that outset. Mexico City in 1985 was quite remarkable. It was a huge earthquake that killed 10,000 to 20,000 people, damaged the central city extensively. But it was also a disaster in which many people there say that civil society was reborn. The government was corrupt and distant and incompetent, a bit like the Bush administration in Katrina. And people had to rescue and organize and improvise the conditions of their survival themselves. And in that, they found that the government was not only not as overwhelming and omniscient as it seemed, it wasn't even relevant in some ways. It was also very corrupt and callous in how it dealt with the disaster. People found each other in some sense, found civil society. The first independent women's union, a seamstress's union, was organized out of the wrecked sweatshops, sewing facilities, tenants' unions that gain housing rights and actual houses for huge numbers of Mexico City. Poor people arose and all kinds of other stuff. But more than that, you know, those are the things that are very concrete and quantifiable. A lot of it was less tangible, as it has been in a place like New Orleans. And it included really the spirit that brought about the end of one-party rule in Mexico, challenges to the just a lot of other things like that that changed Mexico City and the whole country of Mexico. So disasters are enormously catalytic events that can change everything. In China, they used to call an earthquake a sign that the regime had lost the mandate of heaven and expect political upheaval in the wake. And you can see that Hurricane Katrina or the Mexico City earthquake were signs in some ways that the regime had lost the mandate of heaven. It's certainly where the Bush administration became vulnerable to critique, or where people became emboldened to finally critique and challenge and reject and oppose things that they'd been too cowed to do since 9/11.
And perhaps you could just point out there that that's different than someone who might say that the earthquake was punishment for, you know, abuses by people who were involved in it. You know what I'm talking about?
You mean people who think that a disaster is the judgment of God?
Yeah,
you know, fortunately, no, you know, we know what causes earthquakes and hurricanes. And fortunately, other than a few crazy fundamentalist preachers, nobody really tries that stuff anymore. And when you look at the devout people in Pakistan who just got devastated by colossal floods, or New Orleans is also a very spiritual and religious place. It's got huge Catholic and Baptist communities, et cetera. And I think it's not only crazy, it's incredibly callous to say those things about any community hit by a disaster.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Solnit. She will be speaking tonight in Portland at the First Unitarian Church. That's at 7 p.m. Can you talk a little bit about your personal connection, because you have experienced being right at the heart of certain disasters?
Yeah, 21 years ago, the week before last, on October 17th, 1989, during a World Series in San Francisco, there was a major earthquake actually centered south in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I was fascinated by my own response and the response of people around me. We were very fortunate. I was in Italy last year, where they were very hard hit by an earthquake that shattered the Renaissance-era central city on the Bruzi district. And people said to me, you know, if this was California, nobody would have died, because we build out of wood, because we have good building codes, etc. Very few people died in the 1989 earthquake. And what fascinated me was first my own reaction, which is somebody that I'd been angry at, I just never thought about again, that I was thrown into this very intense sense of the here and now. I was very connected to the people immediately around me. I stopped thinking about things that were far away, like, you know, what I was going to do with my life in 10 years, or, you know, my childhood. I stopped worrying about things far away. You're really drawn into this very intense here and now. You suddenly have something in common with everybody, because you've all been through this tremendous thing together and everybody wants to talk about it. You know, that things that used to matter don't matter anymore. Everything is different in some way. But what I found amazing was this enormous sense of joy, which I found in many disasters, in the London Blitz, during World War II, in the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, after 9/11 in certain ways, in many, many disasters, there's a kind of joy. And it's really about the fact that in some ways, everyday life is a disaster, of isolation, alienation, purposelessness, in which a lot of people don't have meaningful work, aren't very connected to their society, don't feel a sense of power, etc. Disaster sometimes, you know, not only gives you death and destruction and ruins, and but also sometimes gives people, and not always, and this is, I'm not advocating for disasters. It would be better that they not happen, but so they do happen, and there's a lot of them that will happen because we're in an era of intensified climate change and of vulnerable communities. Often people do find this extraordinary joy of meaning, of immediacy. You know, you stop worrying about whether your mother loved you or how your investments are doing. Those things don't matter, you know, in this moment. It's almost a Buddhist moment of non-attachment to material and distant things, of a sense of connection, non-separation to all things. Death is in your face, but it makes you more alive rather than more fearful. You know, you improvise, you collaborate, you're deeply connected. You know, the accounts full of joy over and over and over again from Mexico, from San Francisco, from New York, from New Orleans, from these disasters is really astonishing. And, you know, and that's really what got me started, that and starting with my own experience 21 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And the general picture, media picture of Katrina and its aftermath has not publicized this part of it very much.
What? You know, there was some coverage of the altruistic and generous stuff. There was some very great, funny stuff, like in Waveland, Mississippi, which was really hard hit. There was a Pentecostal church from Bastrop, Texas, I think, and a group of Rainbow Family volunteers set up side-by-side kitchens and ended up kind of really having this great cross-cultural rapport that would have never happened otherwise, and also not incidentally fed you know, thousands of people for many, many weeks and into months. And the Rainbow Project evolved and lasted. But, you know, most of the coverage immediately was focused on New Orleans, which was hardest hit, not by the hurricane. Other places were harder hit, but by the floods because the levees failed. So you already were looking at man-made failure, not natural disaster. But the media went hysterical and I think extremely racist. They promulgated all these rumors, which were baseless rumors about mass murders in the Superdome and the convention center, mass rapes of babies and children. There was a rumor of cannibalism that the Huffington Post circulated, and all this loaded word about marauding gangs and looting. And looting basically means theft, and is theft very exciting? You know, and there was graffiti that was approved, people reproduced very approvingly that said, "We shoot looters." That if it said, "We believe in the death penalty without benefit of trial for minor property crimes," people might not have been so enthused about, but that's what "we shoot looters" means. Mm. You know, white people taking emergency supplies were referred to as foraging. Black people were referred to as looting. And it was just repulsive. And it wasn't only repulsive, it was very destructive. Those reports fueled the panicky behavior on the part of the mayor, the police chief, FEMA, the governor, etc., where instead of treating New Orleanians as suffering victims, they treated them as enemies and used military terminology for, "We're going to take this city back." And Governor Blanco said, "We have troops fresh from Iraq, and their guns are locked and loaded, and they know how to use them." And it's like, we're talking about grandmothers stranded on roofs and babies and people dying of dehydration and heat stroke, and your focus is on troops who are locked and loaded. So that it went immensely wrong. And this is part of what made me feel I had to turn that Harper's article that went to press that day into a book. So I felt people really needed to understand what really happens in disaster. Most, you know, you do have a minority who behave badly. They're often people like, in that crisis, the governor, the mayor, the police chief, they're often the people in power. The great majority of people are, in fact, calm, generous, altruistic, and deeply creative and brave in how they respond. And there had been coverage, but I don't think it's been adequate. And there have been some stories on the rebuilding efforts. But the sheer scope of it is astonishing. And I think the New Orleans I saw 6 months after Katrina, which was still mostly abandoned and intensely wrecked, 80% of the houses in New Orleans had flood damage. You know, that city could have died, and it was brought back essentially by love, and which is what you could call both a passionate love for their city that New Orleanians have, and which turned into this active force to come home and rebuild that's still happening, because a lot of people are still coming home, still rebuilding. But also those volunteers all over the country, people who gave money, so many church groups sent building crews, wrecking crews, et cetera, down there. There were Mennonite, and there's everybody from young anarchist kids to Mennonite carpenters who are incredible carpenters, you know, and everybody else in there, the Red Cross and Catholic Charities and things like that. And that's been extraordinary. That, I don't think, has been covered adequately.
Mm-hmm.
Although the story of Katrina has changed in meaningful ways, and 5 years later, that anniversary of August 29th, 2010, there was a lot of focus on institutional misconduct, on police violence and police murders, thanks to the work of my friend A.C. Thompson in particular. And the story had really shifted. I was glad to see, because that's one of the things I was very dedicated to, was shifting the story, because that story demonized people. It taught people to be afraid of each other in disasters. And it wasn't true. And the real story of Katrina, the real story of what happens in disasters, matters for all of us who are anywhere you are on Earth. You may find yourself in a major disaster, and knowing what to be afraid of and what not to be afraid of, and how people are likely to behave, and what you need to worry about, is as valuable as your flashlight and your emergency water for survival.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Rebecca Solnit, who will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church. Her book, now out in paperback, is A Paradise Built in Hell. Have you been observing the disaster in the Gulf with the oil spill to BP?
Yeah, I went down there in July to report on it for the London Review of Books, and I've been following it in different ways. And it's a very intense and sad disaster, although it was great to see is the toughness of people who've been through Katrina. They weren't going to be passive and wait for rescue. They weren't going to trust these big federal bureaucracies. They certainly weren't going to trust the oil companies. They'd learned a lot about what can go wrong in disaster and how to cope. There was a lot of solidarity and resourcefulness. There was good coverage of what was going wrong in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think that it was, you know, it should have never happened in the first place. And the Obama administration didn't handle the cleanup particularly well. BP was allowed to run the Gulf like they'd bought it, and to kind of control the media, control the cleanup, et cetera, in ways that were horrendous. But people were very resourceful in the face of it. They are also very despondent. And a lot of people said to me, this is worse than Katrina. We know how to clean up after a hurricane. We don't know how to clean up. We don't know if you can clean up after an oil spill. It was different, too, in that Katrina hit 90,000 miles of the Gulf Coast and devastated them. But this was hitting specifically rural people. It wasn't affecting the cities, you know, the city of New Orleans as directly, although you could smell the spill from there, even though it's 90 miles from the epicenter. It was affecting the seafood and the tourism and things like that. And it's one of those things, it's subtler, it's not as visual, and that will be affecting the economy for decades to come. Right after I went down there, I met a man who's been studying the Exxon Valdez spill, and he said, you know, it's not over. People are still devastated. It's still affecting physical and psychological health. The fishing community, you know, was decimated. The wildlife is still suffering. You know, and that's one of the tricky things, is people often think a disaster is the, you know, the day the hurricane hits, or the 3 minutes the earth shakes or something. But, you know, there's a funny way in which they're never quite over. Nothing is ever quite the same again.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up a question of how can people retain the sense of community or purpose and joy when the sort of the most media exploitative or whatever part of it is over? How does
you mean
that,
when the drama is over?
Yes.
You know, that's one of the really big questions for me, because I think it's very You know, I think with disaster, it's like being shaken awake. If you think of most of us as sleepwalkers, this is, you know, this literally shakes you awake. And the question is how to stay awake. And that's a discipline. I think that there's a lot of political and religious and cultural ways of being more compassionate, more aware, more empowered. And that there's a, you know, there's no one formula. But I think it's really, it's partly about being aware of what really matters. What are your essential values? You know, we're constantly being told, bombarded by advertising, telling us that we want commodities, we want to consume. And we're constantly being told by the authorities that safety and comfort are our first priorities. But it's interesting how when all of those things have been annihilated in a disaster, people are energized. Because I think what people deeply want, and this way that we don't talk about, we don't have a language for, they want to be members of a civil society, they want to be citizens, they want to be, they want to live in public as well as private, and there are these public loves that matter. They want to belong, they want to have power, they want to have voice, they want to have meaningful work. And I think when you recognize those core values, you can act on them in how you construct your everyday life, whether it's what you do for a living, what you do as a volunteer, what groups you belong to, the ways you participate in your society, etc. And you see that happening in many ways. And there's so many dialogues now that I find very exciting, some of them around food politics, around housing, around public space and transportation, around economics. And at the bottom is a sense of how do we form a more altruistic and inclusive and collective society? How do we back off from the isolation that privatization and individualism have led us into? And, you know, and there's a million answers. There's not one formula. So to me that, you know, that the, it's a basic awareness to stay awake, and then it's a practice that it's not just thinking those lovely thoughts, it's going out and living them in some way. The left is very fond of suggesting that that everything is terrible and we need to start good things. But my position, particularly from doing this book, is there are many remarkably beautiful and lovely and good things and projects and programs and communities and people out there. They already exist. And, you know, we need more, they need to be more powerful. But that, you know, these things are already here.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Solnit. Rebecca Solnit will be speaking in Portland tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church Sanctuary at 1211 Southwest Main. She will be delivering the Sewell Lecture. And what is your topic going to be tonight?
I'm going to talk about altruism and other things based on the book On a Paradise Built in Hell, focusing a lot on those kinds of desires and possibilities I've been discussing, where they come from and, you know, what they frame as the society we could live in.
We have three pairs of tickets to Rebecca's talk tonight available to listeners. And so right now we're going to make those available to the first three callers to our reception desk. That's 503-231-8032. 503-231-8032. You must be able to come in today during business hours to pick up those tickets. So, Rebecca, you recently wrote an article that was published on TomDispatch.com about the invasion of democracy crushers. Oil industry monsters work to destroy the planet. And in it, you talk about the crusades or jihads of corporations and the religion of maximum profit, the religion of unfettered capitalism. So I wondered, just as you see the communities that arise in a disaster, do you see communities of resistance rising in this age of corporate overload?
Absolutely. I was in Seattle in 1999 for the WTO, and I saw that popular power that did so much. I should say, you know, 9/11 is one of the disasters that did not create a great long-term flowering of popular power. It was not Mexico City in 1985. But one thing that arose out of it is TomDispatch.com, this wonderful progressive political website, completely run by one quiet book editor who had to do something after 9/11, the wonderful Tom Engelhardt, I've been writing for since 2003. And this was my latest piece. And It's funny because there's a way in which you adjust, you know, you come to accept the unacceptable. And I think that a lot of people have for corporations. You look at how powerful they are, what a role they play in what is supposed to be a democracy. The essay I wrote is about Proposition 23 in California, which was written and funded entirely by Texas oil companies and would overturn our wonderful climate change legislation that's really going to, you know, turn us away from fossil fuels towards renewable, alternative, non-carbon producing energies. You know, and so essentially these Texas companies are trying to sabotage our democracy, and they've put millions of dollars into it, and it's obscene. And so the way I really wrote about it is, you know, most of us grew up on horror movies and monster movies where, you know, the pods have come to Earth, the Martians have come to Earth, the living dead are among us, the vampires, whatever. And we know that monster movie model, and it's, you know, it's sort of fun, it's sort of scary and creepy. And I think it's a very good way to think about corporations. You know, our democracy is supposed to be by the people, for the people, but it's so controlled by corporations. They're not human. They're not carbon-based life forms like we are. What is good for us is bad for them and vice versa. They don't have our best interests at heart. And the passage you read came from something the novelist John le Carré said on Amy Goodman's radio program, Democracy Now!, that I thought was quite astonishing. He said that I think the crimes committed in the names of the shareholder, dare I say it, are as terrible as the crimes committed in the name of God. And that's where I got and in a funny way, the shareholder is a religion. The religion of, like, the profit is sacred. You must never interfere with it, you know, which has given us this kind of religion of capitalism where it's blasphemy to say, let's do what's good for the public rather than what's good for the market or the shareholders or the profit margin. And, you know, so that was the premise from which I was writing about this, mm-hmm. You know, these Texas oil companies invading my state.
Yeah. Yeah. And they seem to be providing money for elections all over the country.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things. And that's it. I was like, if you want to talk about being taken over by aliens, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4. I mean, that's what happens in these monster movies, is that people get co-opted or they become zombies or pod people or the living dead or vampires. And, you know, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to have unfettered corporate money in our electoral system in January. And that's that doesn't even have to be disclosed. And that's a huge blow to our democracy. And that's, you know, they're like, you know, clones or zombies or something that they're working. They're not working for us. They're working for them. So,
Rebecca Solnit, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Look forward to your talk tonight at the First Unitarian Church. That is at 7 p.m. tonight in downtown Portland. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you. It's lovely being back in Portland.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine.
And bending low as if to hear.